traveling music for you there. Wildlife traveling music. There's a lot of traveling going on among our wildlife these days, especially young wildlife. There's a lot of babies being born. That's one of the things we'll talk about with our guests today. I'm Larry Mueller, talking about the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife with our two guests, Jamie Knack. Jamie, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me, Larry.
Jamie, a UW Extension Wildlife Outreach Specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. And David Drake. David, good to see you, too.
Hey, thanks for having me, Larry.
David's a professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. And we'll take a look at all things wildlife going on here in Wisconsin with both of them. And certainly look forward to your questions and comments. You can call in. Maybe you've had a wildlife sighting. Maybe there's something relating to a baby animal of some sort. I hope you'll join us. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Already had a video post that we can talk about. And if you've got a wildlife photo that you want to include as well, go to our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post it right there. And, of course, you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And I'm just now trying to get up that video, Jamie Knack, of a whole bunch of baby this's and that's.
Yeah, I had gone on and looked at your Facebook page before we got in the studio this morning. So there was a video, and I think we tracked it down to a zoo in Oklahoma,
Broken Bow.
Yeah, and so there was a fawn in a some type of small enclosure, like the size of maybe a dog kennel or a small, relatively small box, but a fawn in there, maybe some kitties, look like a skunk and a raccoon. And so the post was just talking about, you know, this is baby animal season, and it certainly is.
It's cute.
It is very cute. It is very, very cute. And we're going to use that video to talk a little bit about what keeping wildlife wild. So yeah. This new campaign, a couple years old now, is a partnership between DNR, wildlife rehabilitators across the state, and also UW Extension. And it's a combined effort to educate the public on when to intervene with young wildlife or injured wildlife or orphaned wildlife. And when, even though we think they need help, they really don't. Everything they're doing is completely normal. They just take care of their young a little different than we do. And so I want to make sure with that video being posted that folks understand that this is a facility that has presumably a license, a permit to be able to have young animals. And also that this is having young animals isn't something that you or I are qualified to take care of. They have very specific needs in terms of their habitat, their social interactions with other species, and there's other concerns we can talk about too, but disease risks. As they get older, you know, they might become less less timid and more aggressive. And so lots of reasons why wild animals don't make good pets. And we can talk again about some of the situations that people find themselves in this time of the year where they encounter young wildlife and how best to help that animal.
And, you know, some of the larger animals, there could be some problems there. I've been in situations in northern Wisconsin where I've actually come upon a mom black bear with a couple of little ones. And fortunately, I wasn't between them, and I backed away and got out of there. But that could be a dangerous situation.
Yeah, and generally black bears, you know, large carnivores and so on, most wildlife are going to be more fearful of humans. So their first reaction is going to be to skedaddle out of that area. But when they're defending young, or as you mentioned, if you would happen to get in between young cubs and the adult, just like ourselves, human nature, mm-hmm. I mean, we're there to protect our young. So in those cases, too, it's best to back off slowly, make yourself big, and talk, you know, retract yourself from that situation.
Yeah, I can remember also going down a trail in the woods in Saskatchewan and a mom elk and mm-hmm. her little one, and that mom elk did not look pleased to see me, and I did not proceed forward.
Yeah.
I backed up and got the heck out of there.
Well, and I think when we're hiking by ourselves, we're typically pretty pretty quiet. And we want to see those close encounters, not maybe of that nature, but we want to see nature close up. So we tend to be quiet while we're out there. But at this time of the year, if you are in bear country or it's thick cover, it would be important to, you know, hoot and holler every now and then or whistle mm-hmm. your favorite song and just, you know, not sneak up on
what if somebody comes on a, let's say a bird's fallen out of the nest or a situation like that?
Yeah, so that is one of the more common, one of the situations I was helping with this spring was with owls. So I had a friend who sent me a picture of a young owl, fully feathered, on the ground, saying this owl baby needs help. It looks like it fell out of the nest. Well, those are altricial young. Altricial meaning that when they're born naked and helpless. They can't care for themselves. They need mom to help with that feeding. When they're in the nest, they're called a nestling, and altricial young typically need 10 days or so to fully develop to the point where they fledge. They leave the nest. So they have feathers, and they're starting to have short little bouts of attempts to fly. And in the case of this owl, it was a fledgling. It was on the ground, but it was still being cared for by the adult owls, which she let me know were in the area yet. And that's completely normal. Those adults will hop to the ground and feed that chick and be around. And so we didn't intervene. I just encouraged her to watch. And for the next couple of weeks, she got to, and her family got to enjoy watching this owl family in their backyard and probably help them with their rabbit population this spring as well. So that would be a case where that's completely normal. Fledglings fledge the nest, bluebirds, you know, any type of nest box that you might have, robins, and they're often feeding those fledglings for a few days before they're fully capable of flight.
You were talking about food, and actually Bill, who's near Kettle Moraine, has something relating to food, so let's go there. Bill, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, I'm actually driving, so I hope you can hear me okay.
Yeah.
I just had a real quick question about if you all had an opinion on putting like table scraps out in the yard for wild animals. I've got like a little raccoon family that lives in the neighborhood, and they come around, you know, right around dusk, and I typically just sort of, you know, put stuff out there, and I'm not sure if that's okay or not.
Okay.
Bill, thank you very much for the question, and you're probably not alone in doing that, but it is widely recommended that you do not feed wild animals. For one thing, they don't need your help, and the exception, the great exception to this is backyard bird feeding. Again, even in the wintertime, most of the birds don't need our help feeding them. Even in the wintertime, they can usually fend for themselves pretty well. The exception is that with backyard bird feeding, it's such a widely done activity, and people enjoy it so much that for the most part, it's overlooked. But for all other wild animals, it's best that you do not feed them for a whole host of reasons. Number one, it might be illegal depending on what the species is. For example, down here in the southern part of the state and other parts of the state where chronic wasting disease has been discovered, it's illegal to feed or bait deer. So that you don't spread that disease. It's not typically good for the animals. It concentrates animals typically in small areas where you have larger concentrations of numbers of animals than you typically would have, and so disease can spread that way. And as nice as it is to have the raccoons come to your yard, eventually what might happen is that they, in the winter especially, they might start looking for places to get into your house because your house is warm, your chimney, your attic, things like that. So the more time they spend in your yard, then they start creating some problems. They could start digging up your turf. They could start, you know, destroying your plants, gardens, whatever the case might be. But the other issue is that as much as you might enjoy feeding the raccoons, your neighbors may not, and the raccoons are not going to be concentrated or constrained just to your yard. They're going to be moving through your neighbor's yards. And as raccoons or any other animal you start feeding, they get used to human beings or habituate. Then they start losing fear of human beings, and then they can start becoming more aggressive, especially if they're used to getting food from humans. If a human being is walking past them or is in that vicinity, the raccoon may approach that human being expecting to get fed. And if that human being doesn't know to feed the animal or has no food or doesn't want to feed the animal might start becoming aggressive. So the bottom line is, as much as I know it's enjoyable to see those animals, please don't feed wild animals. They don't need the help.
Let's take a call from Lori in Crandon, Wisconsin next. Hi, Lori.
Hello, I had to turn my radio down.
All right, how can we, what's on your mind today? Are you there?
Are you there?
Go ahead, Lori. I think we lost Lori. Oh, well, that's...
It's too bad. Yeah. She looked like she had a good question about loons.
Well, we'll get her back, and we'll, Lori, you can call back if you want to, and we'll get you on because it sounds like you got a good question there about loons. Last time you guys were on, we talked about the Wisconsin Birdathon. Remind listeners what it is and tell us how it's going. We did a show on this not too long ago after you guys were last on, but. The Birdathon, what's the money used for?
The money is used for a whole host of bird conservation projects. So, for example, right now the money is going to support Kirtland Warbler conservation. And Kirtland Warbler is one of the most endangered bird species in the United States. It's supporting efforts to look at owls and hawks and nighthawks and things like that. Restore stopover habitat for migrating birds. Reintroducing whooping cranes to eastern North America. There's a fabulous program here, Wisconsin Bird Cities, that supports that program, and a host of other bird conservation efforts. So it's a pretty impressive thing that they've got going on. I think since 2012, when the Wisconsin Birdathon started, they've raised over $200,000, and essentially the purpose of the Birdathon is a fundraiser for bird conservation. So this year, I think, is the biggest year they've had. The Birdathon typically goes from April 15th to June 15th. You do not have to be a birder to participate. If you don't want to go out and find birds, you can certainly donate money from your couch, and you don't even have to go outside if you don't want to do that. Although finding the birds is half the fun, but essentially teams kind of organize themselves. They volunteer to go out and over a 24-hour period, anytime between April 15th and June 15th, they go out and find as many birds as they possibly can. So either by sight or sound, it's an honor system. So, mm-hmm. You know, the idea is that you're going to go out and not lie about this. And most of the time, birds are pretty ethical, yeah. Honest people for the most part. But this year, so far, with about a week left, they've raised – or I'm sorry, no, it ends tomorrow, but they've raised $85,000 already. So they surpassed their goal of $75,000 this year. And I think the neat thing for me, Jamie and I have participated in this with our students at summer camp a few years ago. We had a great time. We dedicated a day at summer camp doing this. But the neat thing is just to see the wide range of people. I mean, you've got – teams that are organized simply of young adults and kids. You've got teams of retired people. People are finding birds solely in canoes and kayaks on stand-up paddleboards. Some people are finding birds by biking. Some people are doing it by cars and stopping and getting out and seeing birding hotspots. Other people are just walking or running as they go. And so it's just this fabulous way to get people outside, get connected with nature and birds in particular, and raise money.
And again, to get more information, or where what's the site?
Probably if you just Google Wisconsin Birdathon.
That's probably
probably the easiest thing, or the Great Wisconsin Birdathon. That's probably the easiest thing to do. And again, it ends tomorrow, but they'll do it again next year. And if you want to participate, either by organizing a team, being a member of a team, or donating money and send a check. Absolutely.
Okay. Yep. Well, Lori in Crandon is back, so let's go back to Lori. Hi, Lori. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
So I wanted to just share a really cool story that happened to me and my husband about a week ago. We both really enjoy being on the lake fishing. We absolutely love the loons. We love listening to them sing during the day, at night. We just love watching them. This year, we actually were blessed in some of our travels to actually see a loon nesting just off of the shore, and that's been real fun. But this past weekend, when we were fishing, we had this amazing experience, and I have never heard of this before. As we were fishing, I saw what I thought were two very large bass synchronized swimming underneath our fishing lines and around the boat. And I said to my husband, "Wow, look at those huge fish." And he looked closely and he said, "Those aren't fish, those are loons."
Yeah.
And sure enough, those two loons popped up like 3 feet from our boat. One of them, I don't know whether it was the male or the female, raised himself up really high in the air and started kind of like flapping his wings as if to say hello. they watched us for a minute, we watched them for a minute, and they left as quickly as they came, but it was just amazing.
Yeah, I've had that happen to me, muskie fishing in northern Wisconsin, Lori. That's a great story, isn't it, Jamie?
Yeah, it's just gorgeous. The loons and just that sentiment, they really represent the north woods of the state, although we certainly have loons here on the larger Madison Lakes as well. But their call, their yodel, it really is a beautiful sound.
But of course, if you're fishing, you don't want loons around. Muskie fishing might be the exception, but you know, panfish, you certainly don't want the loons around.
No. Very well worth it.
Yeah.
Thanks, Lur.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Jamie Nack and David Drake from UW Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Our guests, I'm Larry Mueller. Michelle Johnson, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network, taking a look at outdoor wildlife here in Wisconsin with our two guests, Jamie Nack and David Drake. And call in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Shoot a photo of yours or send a photo of your favorite wildlife picture to our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. You can ask a question there, or you can simply ask your questions via email at ideas@wpr.org. Bill in Madison up next. Let's go there. Bill, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, so yesterday I was driving along a country road, and I saw a snapping turtle just kind of sunning itself on the side of the road, kind of on the gravel shoulder. And one of the saddest things I can think of is seeing a turtle that's been killed on the road. So I wonder about whether or not to move these animals, and if they're pointed in one direction, is that necessarily the direction they really want to go?
Yeah, well, that's a good question as well.
It's Jamie? An excellent question. And this is the time of year where we are seeing turtles moving across the road. And so they're typically going from a wetland or a lowland site to an upland site to lay eggs, or returning back to the wetland site because they have laid their eggs. So if you do see a turtle crossing the road, the first thing is your own safety. I can't emphasize that enough. So no life is, you know, your life is not worth risking getting injured by passing cars. So if it's a slow country road and you feel that you can safely park your car and go out and help that turtle across the road, you certainly can do that. But on the Beltline, on the interstate, places like that, it would be very risky to do something like that. So in terms of where to move the turtle, you always want to move them in the direction they are going. They know best. They've likely been in the area for years. And if you move them back the way they came from, they're just going to have to start over. So painted turtles, some of the, you know, the smaller species, no problem to just, you know, kind of pick them up or help scoot them across. But those snapping turtles, you need to give them some room. So the best thing to do is if you happen to have a shovel in the back of a truck or something like that, or if you can find a large stick, is to help scoot them across using a tool so you're not coming into contact. And surprisingly, they can really reach that neck out a fair distance.
Ways.
And they are very quick. So.
Yeah.
But yes, it would be admirable to help turtles cross the road, avoid them if you see them in the road, but certainly your well-being is of utmost concern.
Yeah,
the only thing I'll add, I agree with Jamie, everything she said. The only thing I'll add is that this time of the year, especially you'll see turtles on the side of gravel roads, as I think Bill mentioned, and typically what they're doing is nesting. So if the animal is in the process of digging a nest or depositing eggs or covering that nest back up, so they'll lay the eggs and then they leave. The environmental soil temperature is what incubates the eggs. If they're in the process of laying eggs, just leave them be.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go up to Facebook for a minute. We have a visitor post. It looks like a claw, or I would say a talon, maybe. It's long. It's 4.5, at least 4 inches.
Yeah.
Long. Any idea as to what that is?
What color are osprey talons? Are they?
Yeah, but that's long though
for
a talon. I was wondering.
This is from Todd.
I was wondering if Todd could add a little bit more information. Where do you find it, for example? What is it made out of? Because as I was looking at that, I was wondering if it wasn't some kind of a hook off of a plow or something like that. I don't know if it's keratin. Clearly, it's something off of an animal. But if it's steel or metal or something. But then I don't know why he'd send it in and think it was off of wildlife. So,
yeah, I bet it's keratin or something like that.
But if Todd could provide a little bit more information about maybe where he found it and what the material is made out of and things like that, that would be helpful.
We've got some great wildlife photos on our Facebook page now. If you go to visitor posts, there's a nice, great shot of a squirrel and
there's a fawn,
a mother deer with her fawn. That's a wonderful picture. A great squirrel shot, another fawn shot. So lots of good photos.
Oh, there's a fawn nursing, it looks like, too. That's pretty neat.
Wow, that is a neat shot as well, a fawn nursing. And we've got a spider. I'm not sure. What's your guess on that?
It looks to me like a nursery web spider.
Okay.
But I'm not an entomologist. I don't know if you have Phil Pelletieri or P.J. Leash on, but they would be... certainly be able to verify that.
Okay. All right. Well, let's go back to the phones and to Tim in La Crosse. Hi, Tim. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks. It's Turtle Fest up here on the Wildlife Refuge. But that's not why I called. Tributaries of the Black River, some of the creeks along the Great River Trail through the Upper Mississippi Wildlife Refuge, we've, in the last year, been spotting otters, river otters. And we've been seeing some pups and just curious about the raising process. We actually been seeing pups on the trail, and it seriously, all I could figure out was they'd gotten flushed downstream, weren't strong enough to swim back up against the current, and were running back up to jump back yet.
Huh? Interesting.
So what can you tell us about river otter pups?
Well, so obviously the otters are mammals, and with any mammal, when they're first born, they're going to be nursed by the mom for a little while. Until they get old enough and large enough. And then they'll start bringing some food back to the pups, and then eventually the pups will start hunting, probably with the parents a little bit and then on their own. But it's not unusual for parents to kind of stash the young someplace. Think about wolves and the rendezvous sites where they just stash the pups and they go out and hunt and then they bring food back. And that very well might be what's going on. They also might be old enough that they're able to kind of range away from mom right now and kind of do their own thing for a little bit. And, the other issue that could be going on right now is perhaps the mom got, hit or killed by a car or got killed by a predator and maybe they're on their own too. But at this time of the season, we're almost middle of June already. Those animals are probably big enough also to kind of be on their own.
Well, that's because the one I saw was probably 18 inches, excluding the tail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's
interesting about otters, too, is they're a mustelid, and they have, once they have their pups, so they probably have 2 to 4 would be an average litter size, they also breed right away. So those females are being bred.
Yeah, that's a good point.
The male does not stick around that, and help with the raising. So the males will sometimes form bachelor groups and be off on their own. But they go through something called delayed implantation. So that embryo is fertilized, but it doesn't implant until 8 to 9 months later. So I suspect that, it's not necessarily she's pushing them out because she's breeding, because she has, she's being bred as soon as those pups are born. But I think it's much like raccoons do, where those kits are off playing and exploring, and mom is somewhere. She's nearby, but they're starting to really fend for themselves.
That was kind of my assumption. I've seen them in family packs up in the Boundary Waters, but we're just starting in the last year or so to start to see them on the lower Black River here on the north end of La Crosse and some of its creeks. So, yeah, they're good to see.
Yeah, fun to
absolutely.
Watch, for sure.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Jen sent a nice photo of a black bear. Looks like a pretty close shot of a black bear. But then talked about turtles, reminding people not to pick up a turtle by the tail because you can damage that turtle.
Yep. Yeah, it's hard on their vertebrae. And again, even with a snapping turtle, they can really reach that neck around. So best to, on a painted turtle, carry them by the rear of the shell. And on a snapping turtle, find something else to help you move it across the road.
I hope she took that with a telephoto lens of that black bear, because that's an awfully close-up look at a black bear.
That's a pretty big one, too.
Pretty big bear.
Oh, man. Laura in New Berlin, your turn. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Thanks for the program. Just wondering if there are any restrictions when land is undergoing major upheaval in preparation for human housing. There's a 30-acre parcel nearby that had been farmland, and then on May 30th, probably about 1,000 feet of trees and shrubs in what probably was road right-of-way was removed, and since I've been here for many decades, I always see these red-winged blackbirds right in that area on utility wires right above this tree line that was removed, and I wonder if there was a good chance there would have been red-winged blackbird nests that would have then perished, and what about the wildlife that's on the 30 acres itself? I'm just raising the question because we always hear how habitat loss is the number one driver of, you know, the species extinction that's underway.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that call. David Drake?
Yeah, Laura, those are all good questions and kind of large societal questions to some extent. You know, clearly there's a lot of land transformation going on. 85% of Americans live in an urbanized area. And even though we live in an urbanized area, that urban landscape only takes up about 5% of the land mass in the United States. So even though it seems like we have a lot of urbanization going on, if you look at it in the context of across the entire United States, urbanization doesn't take up all that much space on the landscape. With that being said, you know, on private property, you can more or less do whatever you want to do in terms of conserving your land, preserving your land, developing your land, whatever the case might be. The only restrictions that would be is if there were endangered plants or animals on that property, then that landowner would have to abide by whatever state or federal law was governing the endangered species. But I'll throw this out for your consideration, and you were mentioning farmland. I will say this to you. When we talk about habitat loss, we're talking about really good prime quality habitat for wildlife. And so we're thinking about native prairie, for example, or good forest land that does not have a lot of invasive species in it, things like that. Farmland, for the most part, does not offer much wildlife habitat. You know, it certainly offers food when the crops are standing, and it offers some shelter or cover when the crops are standing. But when those crops are harvested and that land is fallow until the next growing season, there's not a lot on that property for wildlife to utilize. And so sometimes, depending on how the development is done, there might be actually more wildlife habitat in suburban residential neighborhoods, for example, than in cropland, especially if that neighborhood's been established for a while and you've got trees and shrubs and plants and bird feeders and all sorts of other things like that. There's actually probably more wildlife habitat in some of those residential neighborhoods than you would find in cropland. But I understand what you're saying. It's hard to see sometimes when you see all this land development going on. But in terms of context, you know, it's not taking up all that much space relative to what's in the United States. And sometimes that urbanization offers some pretty good wildlife habitat, and quite a few species are able to adapt it and use it.
Yeah. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And let's go to Ed and Nina next. Ed, hello. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. Up north on about 1,000-acre fairly shallow lake, we've been dealing with rusty crayfish for maybe 10 years. And there was a period of time when we were trying to trap them and had different people involved, and then we decided that that wasn't a good idea. I just wondered, but there seemed to be more this spring, and I was wondering kind of what the latest scoop is on rusty crayfish.
You know, Ed, that's I don't want to speak for Jamie or Larry, but that's a little bit out of my wheelhouse here. But I will say, obviously, the rusty crayfish are an endangered, or excuse me, a non-native species, so they don't belong here in our watersheds. And it is best if we can get rid of them. So trapping is a common thing to do. One thing I would maybe suggest that you look up, if you have internet resources, go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and just in their search engine type in rusty crayfish. Or go either to University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. They've got an aquatics and fisheries program there. or the University of Wisconsin-Madison here and go to the Limnology Department, L-I-M-N-O-L-O-G-Y, because I believe that they've done some research on rusty crayfish there, and they probably have the most up-to-date information about how to manage it and the spread of the rusty crayfish and abundance and things like that.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. DNR's even has... or at least they had a little recipe for eating rusty crayfish.
I was going to say that was one of the suggestions, is eat them.
And they're good.
Yeah,
they are. We have a photo up on our Facebook page, kind of a sad one, I think, from Leslie of some antler sheds. And it looks to me like there were two deer that may have been hooked antlers. I might be wrong on that, but it looks to me like there's two sets of antlers there, and there looks like the remains of some deer as part of it, and I wouldn't be a bit surprised if those were two bucks that wound up not being able to unlock their antlers.
Right, which certainly happens. I can't tell if that's what it is or if it's material that antlers were tangled
it
in.
It almost looks like the cloth mops
cotton?
Or something like that. But, there's a lot of tine sticking out of there regardless.
Yeah, and it's a photo well worth taking a look at. Go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You don't have to be a member of Facebook just to look and
maybe that poster will contribute to or, respond. But if you if they pried that away a little bit, we'd be able to tell whether that was locked deer or if it happened to get tangled in something, which does happen.
Well,
whether
that happens too.
Playground equipment or clotheslines, fencing.
Yep. Good points. Let's go to Terry next in northern Wisconsin. Hi, Terry.
Hello.
Hi. What can we do for you?
Well, I looked out my front door, and I seen a robin's nest out there. There's a fake pot plant pottery plant right next to the door. And I came home, and there was a robin's nest there, and it was empty. And the next day I came back, there was three eggs in it. And I didn't know if it was robin or not. There were blue eggs, so I assumed they were robin eggs, but... The next day I came, there was four, and I seen both of the birds on the nest, but as soon as I come to the door, they'd fly off. But I've never seen that to where they would be so close. I mean, it's right, if I open up the front door, it's right there.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for that observation, and certainly you have a nest that you can track for the next couple of days and weeks, but it is pretty common for robins and house finches and other passerines to nest in hanging baskets on light fixtures right around the house. So robins typically nest at like shrub height, so not high in the canopy or on the ground, but typically at shrub height. So it's not uncommon that basket, or if it's a light fixture, just provides the structure it needs to be able to build that nest. And then something just to mention, because this often is a question we receive, is somebody wants to know if they can remove a nest that's been on a light fixture or been initiated on a light fixture. And because birds are federally protected, so are their eggs and their nests for most species. So once that nest has been established and there is a single egg in it, it's then protected and you can't remove it. So until that egg is laid, it can be removed. And after the birds have either been depredated or they have fledged, the nest can be removed. So just something to keep in mind. Oftentimes they leave droppings and that can be undesirable, but we encourage people to enjoy being able to watch the progress of that nest and know that it takes about 10 days of incubation and another 10 or 12 before they'll fledge. So it's a rather short period of time.
Yeah, there we go.
We had a, in our garage, we hang our bikes and hang the bike helmets off the handlebars. And so we have a house finch nesting in my wife's bike helmet.
Oh, wow.
So she's been riding unsafe for a while.
Oh, boy.
I want to go back to that photo we were just talking about, because there was a second photo that I hadn't seen from Leslie, and this was a
hammock.
Their hammock was missing in the spring, but their neighbor found this a photo of a big buck on his trail cam. And so what happened was they actually found the shed antler later on.
So there's the rest of the story.
There's the rest of the story. So it was deer. A hammock. So we've got the deer, the live deer.
Wow. That's a good spread on those.
Yeah,
on
that's a big
rack.
Antler. And
the lesson is to remove your hammock before the fall rut.
I guess so.
Right.
Well, those are cool pictures.
Yeah, they are.
Let's go to Madeline in Pierre, Wisconsin. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello?
Hi, Madeline. What's on your mind?
Yes, I wanted to say that I wanted to caution people about just allowing their dogs to just go out and roam when the fawns are out. I was told recently of a case where there was a dog out, and then one of the family members, they heard a commotion. And anyway, apparently the dog had gotten too close to a fawn, and the mother deer chased the dog, and when the family member found the dog, the mother deer had put her hoof right through the dog's stomach. And I said, well, that's the way some mothers are if you threaten their children. So,
yeah.
So I just wanted to caution people about that, about, at that time of the year.
Yeah.
And Madeline, you're absolutely right. And it's not just with deer and fawns that domestic animals may encounter at this time of the year, but also songbirds, rabbits, and all of those. So at this time of the year on public properties, state properties, there are leash laws where dogs have to be on a leash if you're using that property. And some of those, one of those reasons is that to protect young animals, young wildlife being born in that critical nesting time. So on private land too, then it's a good idea to have those dogs leashed at this time, both for their own safety and the safety of young wildlife.
Let's turn to Ted in Stevens Point next. Hi, Ted. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a truck driver, and I drive cross country, and I see a lot of deer on the side of the road. Actually, I'm an animal lover too, so it hurts when I see this, because it seems senseless. And I want to know. Well, this morning I seen a deer and two fawns dead on the side of the road. And I'm assuming that the fawns were, belonging to the deer that was also dead there. And I want to know what's being done to stop this, prevent this from happening, because I didn't see too many of them dead out here.
Yeah. Ted, that's a good question. Before I answer your question, I have a really quick question for you, because I'm enamored with trucks. What kind of a truck do you drive?
I drive a Freightliner.
Okay. All right. Nice to know. It has nothing to do with your question. So here's the answer to this. In the eastern part of the United States, because this will get back to that woman's question about developing farmland for urbanization, because of all the urban development that's going on and the cross-sectioning of our country with roads and all of the different vegetation edges that are being set up with fragmenting the landscape and things like that, we've created ideal habitat for deer and a whole host of other wildlife species that are kind of edge-loving species, where they use these vegetational edges where forest and prairie come together, or shrub and grassland come together, whatever the case might be. So we've created ideal habitat for deer, and so that's allowed them a lot of food and resources to reproduce and create a lot of young deer and recruit into the population. In addition to that, especially in urbanized areas, and in addition to the fact that the human population is so busy these days in the United States, there's not as many people hunting deer as used to be. So we've got a lot more deer on the landscape. We've got fewer ways to cost-effectively limit the deer population or deer growth. And so we've got a lot of deer running across the landscape and trying to cross roads and things like that. We've got a lot more traffic on the roads as well. And it's just – unwanted situation, but a situation where it's inevitable that we're going to start hitting deer on roadways, and that's one of the ways that is the primary driver of mortality for deer. Unfortunately, it's costly. It's over $1 billion a year for vehicle damage across the United States every single year. It's unnecessary death for the deer. Not all deer get killed, obviously. So you've got injured deer out there, things like that. The peak of deer vehicle collision typically is the first couple weeks of November, maybe the last week of October when they're in the rut. But you also, as you're noting now, you're starting to see more deer on the highway now because we've got more deer in the landscape at this time of the year than any other time of the year because fawns are being born. And so,
and don't the moms kick the yearlings? I mean, most of the deer that I'm seeing are young deer. Yep. They're not fawns. They're like deer about a year old.
Yep. Yep.
Yes, you have naive, young, inexperienced deer, you know, that haven't seen roads before trying to cross roads.
And exactly.
I think, Ted, you know, I mean, you see deer crossing signs when you're driving. You see stretches, you know, deer crossing area for the next 2 miles, so on. We tend to ignore those. So I think one of the solutions to this is public awareness and education of those high peak times to be on the lookout for deer and scanning those roadway right-aways, knowing that deer forage or cross through those areas, and knowing that when you see that first deer, there's likely more behind it. So it's a change in behavior in how we drive and approach the road.
Yeah. So the one more thing. Yeah, thank you for – I got distracted about the trucking. So thanks for answering the question, actually, because I didn't answer the question. But the other thing quickly is deer are what we call – kind of crepuscular animals, so they're active sun up, sun down. So those times of the day and night, also just be extra vigilant and reduce your speed a little bit so you have a little bit more braking distance.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jamie Nack and David Drake from the UW Extension and UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, our guest here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and I want to put out another plug for our special event that's coming up. If you love WPR and the Green Bay Packers, you're not going to want to miss this special event. I'm hosting it at Lambeau Field next week. As a matter of fact, on June 22nd in Green Bay, we'll spend the evening exploring Packers history with team president Mark Murphy and historian Cliff Crystal, followed by a tailgate-style reception. It's a family-friendly centennial event in Green Bay this month. You can still get tickets, and all you have to do is go to our centennial website. Just go to WPR.org/100, WPR.org/100. WPR and the Packers, it doesn't get much more Wisconsin than that.
Nope.
I don't think so.
I suspect you'll have cheese there.
Yeah, tailgate.
Well, there'll be some cheese, probably a beer, and soft drinks. And
sausage.
They're going to be a little everything there. And it's going to be a whole lot of fun. I'll have an hour to visit with those folks, and then we'll have that tailgate. It's going to be fun. But right now, we're dealing with wildlife, and I just have to say that thank yous for everybody who's already posted wildlife photos. You really should go to our Facebook page if you haven't done it yet. Go to Visitor Posts and take a look at the wonderful wildlife shots that we've got up here.
There's been some pretty good ones.
Could make a calendar with those.
Katie has a beautiful shot of a bull elk.
I wonder where that's from.
We have
elk, obviously, in Wisconsin, but
was it one from Wisconsin? It'd be nice to know that.
Or out west, it's a beautiful shot.
Beautiful shot. Katie, you have to shoot a Facebook note back and let us know. Put it under your comments section, will you, on that photo? Let's go to Randy in Edgerton next. Randy, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Hey, I was working security 4 or 5 years ago at campground down in Milton, and it's pretty woodsy around that area. It's right on the edge of town, and I've noticed there's a lot of owls around and stuff, and I was going out early in the morning. There was a storm the night before, and come around the corner, here's a small barred owl, you know, like it had feathers and stuff, and of course everybody's going, well, pick it up and put it in a box. Well, I was too smart for that because that beak, you know, is just like a big shear off of a steel thing. You know, I might not get my fingers nowhere near it. But we did call, the raptor rescue down there and stuff. But before they could get out, I was keeping everybody away from it. And I could see the mother back about 100 yards in the woods. And finally that thing walked right over to that. It stood laid in the road for a while, so I don't know if it was a little stunned, but it walked over to that hickory nut tree, a good-sized hickory nut tree, and they're hard. That's hard bark. And it just walked right up it, you know, like a man walking up it sideways, like the claws were digging in, and it went right to the top of that tree. But I want to know was, do those owls, do they keep frequenting the same area, you know?
Yeah. All good questions, Randy. And you're right to avoid the beak, but what you really want to avoid are those talons, because they will also put some holes in you if you don't have thick leather gloves on if you try to grab the animal. So we've got a whole host of owls in the state of Wisconsin. From, you know, you talked about the barred owl. We've got great horned owls. We've got saw-whet owls, which are some of the smaller ones, short-eared, long-eared, you know, all sorts of different owls. And for the most part, those owls are resident species, so they will occupy a territory, especially during breeding season. They'll defend the territory, and as long as that territory has been productive in terms of good food resources, they can actually raise young, that they will keep coming back to the same general area. Depending on the species, some owls use cavities in trees. Some owls use dead trees that have been topped, and there's a little dead cavity in that area. Some owls will build a nest. And they usually will invest quite a bit of resource and time into those nesting areas. So they will try to utilize those nests and those areas as much as they possibly can year after year after year. And then, you know, the other thing that's interesting about owls are raptors. And raptors usually have not many young, and they also will have what's called asynchronous hatching. So with a cardinal, for example, all the chicks hatch out roughly at the same time, you know, within a day or so of each other. With owls and other raptors, you might have some of these young that hatch out within a week of each other. And so you'll get what's called siblicide, where the older chick will actually sometimes push the younger chick out of the nest to limit competition, so the older chick can get all the food for him or herself. And sometimes when you find owls or hawks at the bottom of the nest, they've been pushed out. Sometimes they're also just fledgling, and they haven't quite learned how to fly yet. So it depends on what the situation is. But yeah, answer to your question is yes, they will return the same area generally.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. We have Joan in Elkhorn wondering what happened to the pheasant count that the rural mail carriers used to do. Has that just gone by the board, Jamie Knack?
You know, I'm not sure, but survey data is available on the DNR's website, so that could be searched. I'm not aware that it has stopped, and I know that biologists are still doing survey routes in their county. So pheasant crowing, spring pheasant crow information is still being collected, whether that's through the rural mail carrier survey in addition to what the biologists are collecting. I'm not entirely sure, but I don't remember seeing anything that had ceased.
All right. Let's go to Amanda in Madison next. Hi, Amanda.
Hi. I was wondering if I could get the experts' opinion on if they believe that deer whistles effectively deter deer from crossing a street when your car is coming down the street.
Yeah, there's been some research on that, and it hasn't been good, has it?
No, it has not been good. So we're laughing because a colleague of ours, Scott Craven, had an issue with answering this question years and years back. But Amanda, the answer to your question is no, deer whistles are not effective in deterring deer from crossing roads for a variety of reasons. Again, you know, especially in those urbanized areas where you've got so many deer, that they are just running across the road. There's so many roads for them to cross and things like that. But the other issue is think about how much noise your vehicle makes. I mean, you've got tires on the road that are making noise. You've got the car moving through the air. Sometimes if you still have antennas on your car that aren't built into the windshield, those antennas are whipping through the air. There's a lot of noise as cars are traversing on roads. And if the deer can't hear that, and I understand the deer whistle is this ultrasonic whistle that is supposedly in the deer's hearing range. But, you know, the deer can also hear cars and vehicle traffic. And if they cannot hear the car coming, that deer whistle is not going to do much good for them either.
Yeah.
I suppose that makes sense.
Yeah, there's been some...
There has been published research, you know, in a design study. And I would say same thing when we have folks ask about ultrasonic for mole control and things like that. A lot of that has not panned out in research studies.
There we go.
Darn.
Yeah, it's too bad. It's really too bad. Thanks, Amanda. And Tim and Genesee Depot, thanks for calling.
Hello there. My apologies first. I didn't listen to the first 20 minutes or so, so I'm not sure if you've answered something like this before. But my wife and I live on a real wooded lot near Genesee Depot, and every year that we've been out here, we see a lot of gray squirrels. Well, we see gray squirrels all during the year, but about this time, and it just happened last week, we have a whole bunch of young seems to be young squirrels just cavorting all over the yard, chasing each other, squawking. They'll come up to our screen door and kind of look inside. And yesterday when I went down about 6 o'clock to get the newspaper, two of them were in the trees, and they stopped, and they were probably 10 feet from me, and they just looked at me. And I'm just wondering, do young squirrels just all of a sudden get out of the nest and say, holy cow, this is really exciting here. We're just going to have fun.
Okay. I had the same experience a couple weeks ago when I was in northern Wisconsin, just happened to come across a nest of squirrels that must have recently fledged, because they were chasing each other. There were 6 or 7 of them in the treetops just having a good old time. So squirrels do have multiple litters, and they have them throughout the growing season here. So I'm guessing that's what you're seeing, is a litter of squirrels that have finally left the nest for good and are moving around. So
it's very entertaining to watch.
For sure.
Oh, very entertaining to watch. Tim, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Again, I want to go back to our Facebook page just to note all of wonderful photos we've got up of eagles.
Nuthatch.
A nuthatch, and
yellow warbler,
a red fox. I was out for my run couple mornings ago, and there was a red fox right in the neighborhood, our city neighborhood.
So fun to see.
Fun to see. We're going to take a quick look at the news, the weather, and we'll find out what else is in store for us on the Ideas Net, and then we will be back with our guests. You stay with us. We're taking a look at the world of wildlife today here on the program. Larry Mueller here with my guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack. Jamie, UW Extension Wildlife Outreach Specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. And David Drake also in that department. And he is a professor in the department and with UW Extension. He's a wildlife specialist. Questions, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org, and by all means, send us your wildlife photos. We're just getting some dandies on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. And I just, before we go back to the phones and Chuck, I wanted to point out a picture from
Brian Kermit.
Brian sent us of ducks. There's a double rainbow over a lake, so you've got the image of the in the lake and then some ducks flying in that shot. Boy, that's one
it's gorgeous.
That's one you want to keep for sure. And there are many, many more good ones. We may get back to those, but I want to give Chuck in Northern Adams County a chance to join us. Hi, Chuck. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I was driving on a county road in Northern Adams County a few minutes ago, and there were a pair of large white cranes. Now, this area is known for sandhills, but I'm wondering if these two cranes were whooping cranes, and they had a chick with them.
You know, Larry, this has been an awesome show, not only with the Facebook post, but we've had some really good questions today, and that's a good question, Chuck. Are whooping cranes native to Wisconsin? And I was trying to rack my brain about this. I know they're certainly native to North America. And they're native to the Midwest. And the reason I'm not sure, well, I'm going to say yes, they are native to Wisconsin, with the caveat of being this. Whooping cranes are migratory. And so they typically go from Wood Buffalo National Park up in Canada down to Florida, Texas, places like that. And so Wisconsin is in their flyway path. And in that sense, I think they're native to Wisconsin in the sense that they don't stay here for very long. They fly through the state traditionally and historically. But what's been going on now in Wisconsin is Wisconsin up in the Nisida Sandhill Wildlife Management Area. They've got what's called a reintroduced experimental population of whooping cranes. And what you probably saw is a whooping crane. They're very hard to confuse with anything else and hard to miss because they're such a large bird. They're all white, and especially when they're flying, they're all white with the exception of on the very tips of their wings, they've got black out there. And there's not really anything else in the sky that's that big and that's that white flying around. So it is very possible. Whether it's a chick or not, it would be awfully early right now for a chick to be flying with the parents. They should still be on the... I'm sorry?
It wasn't big enough to fly yet. It just had the... I don't know what you call them. The puffy.
You saw it on the ground.
Yeah, it was on the ground.
Yep, yeah. So that certainly could be a chick. Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty neat.
Yeah, very neat. Thanks, Chuck, for calling with that. Jan in Viroqua, it's your turn. Hi, Jan.
I have a lovely story about the interface between human and animal habitat. Several years ago in Milwaukee, I was celebrating the 4th of July with a number of other friends at their home. And we were all sitting around the picnic table eating in the backyard under this mammoth, what I call a grandfather tree, really, you know, the 28-inch diameter tree that had branches covering the picnic table. Lovely, lovely spot. And suddenly, four little baby raccoons plummeted out of the tree and landed in the salad bowl.
Oh.
And I don't know who was shrieking the loudest. The stunned humans, the very surprised little animals, or the freaked out mama.
Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy.
Nothing like crashing a party, huh?
Oh, man. You know, that, thank you for that, Jan. I wondered, I was hiking in one of our state parks, and there was a mom raccoon with a whole bunch of babies behind it, and it was made for some great photos. But I wondered at the time how many raccoons or how many babies an adult raccoon would normally have.
Yeah, I just happened to have some of that on raccoons when we were talking about keeping wildlife wild, but 2 to 6 is what their average litter size is.
I think there were 5 or 6 in that litter. It was really something. Well, Jan, it's a great story. Thank you.
And they were like the squirrels you were talking about, because when they managed to get back up in the trees, they were just having a raucous time chasing each other through the branches. The little guys were just chattering away and cavorting. It was a very fond memory. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. John in Ironwood will turn to you next. Hi, John.
Hello. I got a little story I want to relate. It was about this time last year. I was in my garage working in there, and I heard my dog yipping a little bit, so I looked out, and I live on, I've been kind of in the country, and I got the woods in the backyard, and the dog come walking out of there, and a little fawn come walking right out after it. And I guess the mother had just laid the fawn, and fawn must have thought my dog was his mother, but it walked right around in the yard, and it come walking right into the garage. And the dog was... I tell the dog was trying to get rid of him. He was annoyed by it. And finally, the fawn came in the garage, seeing me, and then the dog took off, and the fawn started harassing me. I mean, it was running around my leg, or wobbling around my legs, in between my legs. And finally, I said, well, I got to do something. I took it back out to the edge of the field, or the woods there, where the dog had found the fawn. And they laid down, and then I come back to the garage, and about 3 minutes later, the fawn's back in there again. And it sounded like a blue jay is what at first I thought it was. It's baying away, you know. And I didn't know what to do. I was going to call it DNR or what. But I ended up walking it back. It followed me right back into the edge of the woods. And it lay down. And this time I kind of rushed back and hide behind the trees and got back to the garage. And I was watching. And the fawn was baying some more. And then the mother came right back to it. And they moseyed off into the woods.
Well, John, thank you for sharing that story. I think it has some important lessons in it, too. And I think that what you did and how you handled that was very good. Not to prolong the encounter, to take it back. The only thing, if you had time to throw a pair of gloves on, that's always suggested, just to not have that human scent, even though a mother will generally accept the fawn again, and to just get it right back to where it was in the forest, maybe close up the garage and head in the house with the dog for a little bit and just observe. But you're right, mom's usually nearby, and you made great decisions there. So
yeah, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Wow, we have here's a nice photo from Brian of some prairie chickens.
Yeah, which that's pretty neat.
You don't see a lot of prairie chickens these days here in Wisconsin.
Nope.
Those were prairie chickens up by Wisconsin Rapids.
Yep, so that's the greater prairie chicken. And I used to I got my master's degree on greater and antlers prairie chickens. I used to do some research in graders when I first came to Wisconsin about 12 years ago. And my favorite statistic about prairie chickens is obviously they're associated with grasslands. And historically, they were in the lower third to lower half of Wisconsin. But by the year 1900, they were in every single county of Wisconsin, and that indicates how much land clearing and forest clearing had gone on in the state. And so, and then as the range contraction occurred, they got restrained or confined to the central part of the state where grasslands exist now up in the Buena Vista area and surrounding grasslands up there. But, yeah, so that's an aside. But that's an interesting statistic about prairie chickens.
Well,
yeah.
I think the public can still sit in the viewing blinds. Yeah. So I'll put a plug in for that. But if you look at the prairie chicken, Buena Vista Prairie Chicken Grounds, you can sign up to sit in a blind and watch them on their lek as they're doing the courtship displays. And it is...
It's really something to see.
It's amazing.
I saw it as a young boy with my dad took me and we watched, and it was really fun.
You have to get up very early,
and you have
to stay put until they're off the lek. So that means you have to be careful how much coffee you take.
Those are some cold mornings, and it is amazing the males as much effort they put into attracting the females. It's amazing they still have energy to breed the female when she shows up on the lek.
There we go, Rick in Southeast Portage County up next. Hi, Rick.
Hi. I have an interesting sighting. The other day I saw they were just dots in the sky, very high, and they were in a V, and I couldn't even make them out with binoculars. And I managed to get a spotting scope on them, and I think there were seven or eight of them, and they were flying west to east. And when I got the scope on them, they were undeniably pelicans.
Yeah.
And I looked them up in a Crosley, and they're American white pelican, I believe. And there was just a small dot in their habitat, which may be either Butamort or Winnebago.
Yeah,
I think I got that right.
Yeah, they're expanding, though.
Yeah, they sure are. And pelicans are a bird that's really starting to increase in abundance here. If you go up into the Green Bay area, up in Lake Michigan, you'll see them quite frequently up there. If you go around Horicon Marsh, kind of the southeast central part of the state, you'll see them over there. And it's neat to see them. They're fun birds to watch. They're great. It's fun to watch them dive in the water. They're hard to see, as you notice. They do fly high, and they'll change direction quite a bit, and they can almost disappear in the sky depending on the orientation to the viewer. But they're neat to see.
Yeah.
And if you happen to be in the Madison Sun Prairie area, they're on Patrick Marsh right now daily. So they are fun to watch.
Yeah, excellent. Thanks, Rick.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it. Jim in Stone Lake, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hello. I've got like five chipmunks that I like to feed peanuts here, the real tame. And one of them has bare spots on his back, and but I can't see any parasites on him, and he acts normal, but I'm just wondering what caused those bare spots.
It could be any number of things.
It could be a bunch of stuff, Jim. It could be maybe there's some kind of external parasite like mange that's on the coat that's causing that hair to fall out, or they're scratching so much. It might be that it avoided a predator, but it lost some of its fur. The predator only got a hold of the back fur, and that was it. There could be some other skin diseases going on there. Sometimes they'll clip when you're inside the burrows like that. Animals will clip each other, so they'll start chewing on the hair a little bit. So I'm not sure. There could be a variety of things going on there, Jim, but that's an interesting observation.
I would just continue to watch the chipmunks that come, and if you're seeing that on additional animals rather than just that individual, then I'd be more suspicious of a type of disease or parasite. And at that point, you may want to stop feeding just so they're not spreading that particular disease. Just stop for a while.
Yeah.
But if it's just that single animal and stays that way, I would suggest that it's something that's kind of naturally occurring.
Good point.
Thanks a lot for calling. And once again, back to the Facebook page, there are a couple of videos. There's one video of badgers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Coming out of a den. Yeah.
Coming out of a den. That's really cool. And we've got another one here from Joan of
looks like a fledgling chickadee
on a bird bath. That's really cute, too. That's a video there. And
raccoons, it looks like.
Raccoons in a tree.
Yep. Oh, yeah. There they are. Yep.
Yeah.
I see them.
And
we've got a snowy owl, it looks like. Is that a snowy owl?
Right on the front porch.
It might be too small for a snowy owl.
Yeah.
Sawwet or a screech.
Yeah.
Could be a sawwet owl.
Yep.
Anyway, there's some great photos. Yeah. So please go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show and take a look. There are tons of really cool pictures. And I love that video. I love the video, especially of the badgers, the baby badgers kind of coming out of their hole. It's really pretty cool. Joe in Adams County up next. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, hi. Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I got a question. I always wanted to talk to somebody about this. I was out. I took my dog out for her, you know, natural thing. Took her by her favorite tree. Anyways, I heard a snap. The branch fell down in her with a, what I thought was a cougar. As soon as it hit the ground, my dog wanted to go after it, but I held her back. And this cat took off the other way, which I'm glad it did. And I went to look at where it fell, and I looked at the tracks. And the tracks were about the size of my fist, and there were claws, big claws on the end of it. Now, this animal was like a brownish color with a white belly. It had a big curl tail on it. And it looked like a cougar to me. Now, I live in Quincy Township here in Adams County, and I'd like to know, do we have cougars in this area?
Well, Joe, I don't. So one of the things when we have sightings like this that tend to be a rather rare animal is we never argue. We say you just never know what might be out there. But to answer your question, not confirm what you saw one way or the other, but we have had cougars documented in the state. So a number of years ago, 10 or more now, there were sightings and tracks and trail camera pictures that were popping up. And there was suspicion that there were cougars in the state, but we never had the evidence. So whether that be DNA evidence or a photo that could be verified based on the location, we didn't have that information. Since then, we have been able to confirm, or the state, the Department of Natural Resources, has confirmed individual cougars in the area. They have all been males, likely juveniles that are dispersing animals, and the ones we've had DNA information on have traced back to a population in South Dakota, Black Hills, South Dakota area. And so what's happening is those are likely young males dispersing, looking to establish their own territory. We have yet to confirm any females or any breeding activity of cougars. So they've been through the state, but we don't have a breeding or a current population of cougars in the state. If you go to the Department of Natural Resources website, they do maintain a list of sightings that have been confirmed, so you can kind of look at those. Some of them are on trail camera pictures. Some have been by hair or maybe blood. And then also there are hoaxes with the internet, and David and I, you know, get different pictures sent to us that come from other states, but there's also been a number of pictures of cougars that have floated around in a variety of states. So they have some descriptions on some of the hoaxes that have been passed on people too. So, but to answer your question, there have been cougars documented in the state. In terms of your particular encounter, what you describe certainly sounds like a cougar. Yep. You could probably look at that time frame in the DNR website and if there's been any confirmation in that area. In the future, if you're in that situation, it wouldn't hurt to call the local wildlife biologist, because they would like to come out and try to look at what evidence is there and be able to document that occurrence.
Yeah, that'd be very cool.
Yeah, thanks for the call.
Yeah, thanks, Joe, for the call. Back to Facebook for a minute. Jane sent a photo of an animal that is, the front half is completely black and the back half is kind of a rusty brown, yep. I would, darker brown color.
Yep.
I've never seen an animal that looks like that.
It's a gray squirrel, and it looks like what it's doing is shedding its winter coat, which was a kind of a dark sable brown maybe, and what's coming in is a black coat. And it's not unusual for gray squirrels to have a host of pelage colors. You know, black is very common. There's a kind of a melanistic or a whitish squirrel somebody else sent in a picture of earlier today. So those are some common coat colors. Obviously, the most common is the gray color, but that's what it looks like to me, is it's shedding its winter coat, and a all-black summer coat is coming in.
It's really interesting.
But even
picture.
If you look on the back paws, that the paws look black, even though the winter coat is kind of a sable brown.
Yeah, you're right. Kathy in Sun Prairie, it's your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I'm calling because about the week before Memorial Day, I had a wild turkey who laid 9 eggs in my shade garden. Now, the shade garden is about 40 feet from my back door, and she came one afternoon and just spent the whole afternoon back there behind a tree, and we'd catch glimpses of her and wonder what she was doing. And the next morning, she was gone, and we peeked there, and there were 9 eggs there.
Yeah,
now, she
yeah.
has since come back, and she spends 95% of her time on those eggs.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's pretty neat.
That is very, very cool.
Yeah, and she won't be there much, you know, that much longer. I'm trying to think. Ducks, maybe 28 days.
So
she's probably about that time frame. When those eggs hatch, they will all hatch likely within a 24-hour period. And turkey young, just like chickens, they're going to be precocial. So they're going to be pretty much ready to go and will leave that area. They won't have that nestling state where mother's feeding and caring for them. They'll leave with that hen turkey and start foraging in the grass, picking insects, and trying to get as much protein as they can right away. So, within the next...
This young female turkey has been a neighborhood institution for about like the last 3-4 years. Well, this year, stalking around, never, I believe, has she made... Well, maybe she just wasn't ready.
Well, and in a more urban setting, those nests get depredated pretty frequently. There's a lot of things in that type of setting that would eat those eggs. So she obviously is getting some extra protection in your garden, so...
Yeah.
Oh, yes, and the after all the rains that we had, the vegetation is just quite high.
Yeah.
Of course, I can't get over there to weed now.
Well, enjoy.
Yeah, enjoy it for sure. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Wow. In the last time here, the Wisconsin bat population, I've been getting questions from people about that. What's our status?
Well, in the status here, we're really referring to white nose syndrome, which is a fungal disease that's affecting bat populations. It was first detected in 2006 in New York State and has spread west since then. Documented in Wisconsin, first found in 2014. It's affecting our hibernating bats, so our cave species, the ones that stay here through the winter, as opposed to the other species that migrate. We've had a very active surveillance and research front in the state, but 24 of 28 counties that have known bat hibernacula are now confirmed to have bats infected with white nose syndrome or the fungus that causes it. And so for some of these sites, this is the second or third year of infection, and biologists are seeing population decreases of 30 to 100%.
Oh. Well, listen, I'm looking forward to your next visit. Thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Larry.
Appreciate it very much. Jamie Nack and David Drake from UW Extension and the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. They'll be back on August 2nd. We'll do this all over again. Tomorrow we'll take some time to talk about home improvement and talk about decks. So I hope you'll stay with us for that. In the meantime, stick around, lots in store.